You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
Today's podcast is with Andrew Robertson, who is chair of BBDO Worldwide, where he served as president and CEO for 2 decades. He was inducted into the Advertising Hall of Fame in 2022, and he has taught guest classes at NYU, UNC, and Wake Forest University. He's got a great new book. It's called The Creative Shift, How to Power Up Your Organization by Making Space for New Ideas. Enjoy the pod. Andrew Robertson, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Kevin. Nice to be here.
There is so much crossover between your work in advertising and our work in improv-based comedy, but one of the chief elements we share is actually a misconception from many folks that somehow creative work is magic or a talent that you have to be born with, when in fact, it's highly dependent on creating structures so that individuals can co-create without fear or judgment or shame. It's intentional, it's designed, and a lot of pre-work goes into the spaces in which we seemingly make something out of nothing. And that seems to be at the core element of what you call the creative shift.
That's exactly right. I mean, the data on what happens to us as we grow up in terms of our ability to be creative is absolutely horrifying. Yeah. There was a guy called George Land who was commissioned by NASA in the 60s to identify which of NASA's many, many, many brilliant engineers were the most creative. And it always makes me think that that's the one place in the world where you can say it's not like it's rocket science, but actually it is.
It is.
And he developed a methodology for measuring it that proved to be very, very effective. And he then went on to do the same test with children aged 5, 10, 15, and 20, the same cohort of kids moving through. And at 5, 98% of them classified or tested as creative geniuses, 98%. By the time that they were 10, it was down to 40. By the time they were 15, it was down to 12. And by the time they were 20, it was down to 2%. And some of that is neurological, but the vast majority of it is actually just people changing their behavior and moving from thinking in divergent ways to thinking in convergent ways, which for society to function is probably a good thing most of the time. And my premise in this book is really that the same happens with companies, that companies get really good they get really successful by being very, very good at things that actually are convergent rather than divergent. And in doing so, whether intentionally or not, and I believe it's genuinely not intentional, they kind of suppress the innate creativity that exists within their people. And I believe it does exist within their people. And then, like, as you say, what I want people to do is to use the same discipline and process and structure that they use to make their companies have predictable results and make them operationally brilliant and make them process compliant, all the things that make them successful, use that same discipline and engineering to create the conditions and space to unlock the creativity of their people when and where they need it. I do have this fundamental belief that it's in there. It's in all of us. Enough of it is anyway. Mm-hmm. And it's actually, John Cleese actually said, creativity is not a gift. It's an operating system. And I think that's right. And I know that's what you guys definitely believe.
Yeah. And I think it's worth pointing out that creative people are not immune to falling back into this sort of like convergent thinking. So we have a director, McNapier, who has a thing during the process to create a second city show is like a 10 to 12 week period. And at a certain point, he will have a thing called Taboo Day, where you have to bring in three ideas that there's no way in hell Second City will ever put on its stage.
Right.
And you know, you talk about the need for bad ideas. This is a very similar idea because it's getting people. And inevitably, as you could guess, half those scenes end up in the show.
Right.
So, and these are really, really creative individuals, but even they can do that. So this is a day-to-day thing. And I think what you point out, and it's true, most companies don't think about it as a day-to-day thing, like culture.
No, in some companies, it may need to be very quarantined, and, you know, because I don't really want the Bank of America being overly creative as they ship trillions of dollars around the world every day. But I do want them to be highly creative when they're trying to invent a new credit card or some way of giving me better service. So it's the whole point is not to change those companies into something they aren't.
Yep.
Because I don't want to do that, because what they're doing is really working for the things it's working on. Rather to add to it another process, really, another process that is going to help them generate the ideas that they need to thrive and grow as businesses.
I want to talk to you about focus groups because your field has used and depended on focus groups for a long period of time. We have, I think, an edge in this, which is our focus group is the audience that comes to the show every night.
They laugh and they don't.
So there's no lying in laughter. That you are not fake laughing. So that's an advantage we have. What do you have a frustration with focus groups in your work or do you like
them? I mean, I think that that great line, you know, a fool with a tool is still a fool. Mm-hmm. And I think that I don't have a problem with focus groups per se. I have a problem with focus groups that aren't well moderated and properly run by highly skilled individuals who can use them to get what you want out of them. If all you're doing is sticking something in front of, you know, 8 or 12 people and asking them what they think of it, I don't think you're going to get what you can and should get out of a focus group, which is much more diagnostic and deeper into the psychology of the individuals in the group. And that requires like all of these things, much more preparation, and B, a very, very skilled moderator. Mm-hmm. I just don't think there are as many of those around as there are focus groups. And that means that I think you can end up with some pretty, pretty shallow and frankly, pretty meaningless conclusions from just shoving something in front of 8 people and asking them what they think.
Yeah. For people who don't know BBDO, I'd love you to talk a bit about the company. And in particular, it is very, you know, clients in your field come and go.
Yeah.
You guys have been, GE has been a client for a very long time.
Yes.
That's unbelievable. So talk a bit about that.
I think that when we define what we're here for, it was to create the world's most compelling commercial content. That's what we're here to do.
Yep.
And that means compelling in both senses of the word, compelling as in I can't avoid engaging with this, and compelling as in it changes the way you behave. And our definition of creativity in that respect is the magical ability to capture and hold the attention of an audience while you give them some information or a demonstration or an experience that's changing the way they think, the way they feel, but most importantly, what they do. And that's what we've kind of been obsessed with. Mm. Certainly for as long as I've been here, but it goes back further than that. And it goes back into individual agencies around the world, even further than that. And the reason we we kind of focus and cling on to that is because there's so much good data about how valuable that is in driving our clients' businesses. Our clients don't come to us because they want that. They come to us because they want to grow their businesses. They want to solve big problems. And the way you solve big problems is with creativity and work that that people connect with. So I think we've had a singular focus on that, but probably a lot of other companies, I mean, you'd have to be a fool to say it was a bad idea. Yeah. So, you know what I mean? So a lot of people will talk about it, but there's a difference between talking about it and it being your focus and it genuinely being the focus, which is, you know it's that when it's the basis that you make the decisions every single day, big ones and small ones, are is this going to make work better or not? And if the answer is yes, then we do it. If the answer is no, we don't. So that's what BBDO has been built on. Recently, Nancy Reyes took over from me as CEO, and Chris Beresford Hill have kind of taken it to another level where they talk about BBDO being built to do big things, solve big problems for big clients with big ideas. And I think that if you focus on that and don't get distracted by whatever's the latest, you know, conference headline or the latest trade magazine diatribe or whatever it is, then you will continue to deliver results for your clients. And if you continue to deliver results for your clients, there's a much better chance that they're still going to be with you in, you know, next week. And it's always just a series of next weeks. It's I remember talking to a client once who was talking about an IT project. This was at Shell. He was talking about an IT project that he'd commissioned, and we stood in the room, and the guy who's running the project said that it was 2 years, it was behind schedule by 2 years. Mm-hmm. And he said, how do you get 2 years behind on a project? And the guy was brilliant. He said, you do it one day at a time. and I think we've worked with GE in all of its manifestations, and there have been a lot of them over that period for mm-hmm. nearly 100 years. But you're only ever working for them today. You're only ever working for them on the work that is going to go out next week, because that's what the people are going to see this week. And you know, the heritage is only evidence of our success in doing it every single day. It's not there's no birthrights here.
Yeah. I mean, that it's interesting. It took, I counted 49 pages to get to yes. And I knew it was coming. I had not pre-read. No one told me. I read the introduction. I'm like, he is going to talk about yes. And there's no question. And you do. And I didn't invent it. I just wrote the book, about it. Yeah. But you know, the thing I love about that concept and why it translates so well, for the companies that we work with is, you have to work from a place of abundance, and that requires a different attitude. And you talked earlier about this of creating very specific intentional spaces for this work to happen. So that, I don't want my dentist improvising inside my mouth, except if there's an emergency. But also, my dentist, and I've got a great one, didn't have all these newfangled, cool, cutting edge, technologies that he brought in without experimenting and figuring out. So you have to find these safe places to experiment. So I'm curious, like, at what point did you, like, the yes and thing sort of came into your world? Was that there 20 years ago when you started, or is it something that sort of evolved over time?
I actually heard about it first from a guy called Peter Suter, who was my credit partner when I was in London. And I'm not even sure where he came across it, but
yeah,
here's what I love about it. And I think it's something I allude to if I don't say it out explicitly in the book. It's not enough to tell people what they mustn't do. You have to actually tell them what they have to do. Mm-hmm. And you could just say, you know, don't poo-poo anybody's ideas. That is not going to get you what you need. When you have a structure that says your response has to be yes and, mm-hmm. it forces, it's like having a diet that tells you what to eat, not just not what not to eat. Yeah. And if it says, you know, you need to eat this amount of chicken every day, then people will do it. And I think that level of intentionality is key to generating great ideas. So, you know, the thing I refer to is you're going to need 9 bad ideas if you're going to have a chance of having 1 good one. So what I need from you is 9 ideas. Mm-hmm. Not one. I don't need 1 good idea from you. I need 10 ideas from you. And if we do that, there's a good chance we'll end up with 1. And I think there's, you know, and that's what I said. That's what I love about Yes And is it could have just been written as, oh, you need to make people feel safe that they can have a bad idea or nobody judges anything. You could say all of those things, but it doesn't actually get you what you want, which is a process through which more and more ideas are developed and ideas are constantly improved. It's so easy. I mean, I always talk about an idea is, it's a great line, an idea is so fragile it can be killed with silence. Yeah. And it's like walking across a crowded dance floor with a glass full of water, and it can be bumped, and it's so easy to be bumped in so many different places, and you get to the other side, you've only got half the glass of water. You need to create a process that means that you're going to get to the other side of the dance floor with a bucket, not just with the glass that you started with. And I think that's why I have so much hope for how applicable this kind of process can be for the companies that I'm kind of pitching it to, because they're really good at that. Mm-hmm. They're really good at saying you need to do this and then this and then this and then this. And if they can just apply that to the generation of ideas the same way they do to the, you know, getting planes to leave on time, things, magical things could happen.
We work a lot with the behavioral science community. And when we talked about Yes And, it was very easy for them to connect to it because behavioral economics already says that people's default is to say no or do nothing, right? And so Yes And is a nudge, to use Richard Thaler's term, to have people act and experiment and try. One of the early arguments I got into specifically with Nick Epley at the University of Chicago was his belief that brainstorming doesn't work.
Yeah.
And I'm like, and I'll say this, there are some scientists now who are recognizing that they were just measuring incorrectly. Like, here's what you're not measuring. You're not measuring the 6 actors who've been working together at Second City for a year who improvise every single night and make up stuff. They're very good at this. Measuring strangers coming in and whether they can, you know, successfully brainstorm together is entirely different. And so I feel good that the research is starting to show up, but it's still a bet. And you talk about this in the book as well, that, I mean, there are ways to get to novel, original ideas, and you have had to do it. And I have had to do it in our jobs
for a living. Yeah. That's what we do. Yeah. No, the brainstorming debate for me is an even more extreme version of what we were talking about earlier with focus groups. Yeah. It's a badly prepared and badly run brainstorming session will be non-productive. In fact, it may even be counterproductive. If you prepare properly, if you have a really good question that you want people to attack, if you have the right people in the room, if you create a room that is going to be conducive to generating lots of ideas, if you structure it and run it in such a way that you are building ideas generating ideas, not killing them, if you do all of those things, then you will have a very successful brainstorming session. If you just get a bunch of people in a room together and say, we need to solve for X, there's a very good chance that nothing good is going to come out of it.
Yeah. Let's talk about AI. I work in an industry that is very paranoid about AI. And as a leader, a creative leader, I worked at Second City when the internet happened. All right? I literally remember 17-year-old Simeon Schnapper, who was in the teen group, who was a genius, wiring us up for the internet. We had the first website for a theater in Chicago. And, I am aware that we get these technologies and they will be part of our lives, our day-to-day lives. I think that is true with AI as well.
Yeah.
The fear, which I think is valid, is I'll give an example. My wife runs a comedy major at a college here in town. So it's the first ever BA in comedy writing and performance. One of the things she has her kids do is they're constantly supposed to be making lists. So I need you to do the work of making these lists of again, generating good ideas, bad ideas, other, but generating ideas on a daily basis, because if you want to be a comedy artist, you're going to need a lot of different ideas. I worry that if they have AI do that work, they will miss out on the practice, the sort of muscle building of doing it themselves.
Yeah. I think it's a yes and.
Okay. Love it.
I think we can use AI to stimulate the generation of ideas by generating a load of ideas, because what I've observed happening is ideas breed more ideas. Mm-hmm. Bad ideas, good ideas, doesn't matter. They breed more ideas if you're managing it right. And, you know, the optimist will say, you know what, let's use AI to generate the first 20 really bad ideas. And we'll use those to get everybody else thinking about good ideas or better ideas or new ideas or different ideas, because that's kind of the process you go through if you're just doing it with people. So in that sense, that very functionality could be an accelerator for the process of generating ideas, and especially for getting to good ones. So I'm an optimist about that. I think there is a virtue in, because I believe in the value of bad ideas. I think that we can use it for that. I think there's another really important, and I'm like, it's funny you say that, the internet, the three big tech changes in my career were the introduction of the internet, or rather the widespread adoption of the internet, the introduction of the smartphone, and now the introduction of generative AI. The first two were really about distribution. The first two were really about how you reached people, not how you made content. Generative AI is really exciting for me because of its ability to close the gap between having an idea and bringing it to life. So much of our time is spent trying to get ideas made, trying to close the gap between the idea and the money that's available, the idea and the time that's available, the idea of and whether it's possible to do at all. So much time goes into that. AI is going to make it possible for that gap to collapse, and for anybody who's got an idea to be able to bring it to life in minutes. To me, that's a wonderful thing if you're very creative. If you're able to generate lots of ideas and within them some good ones, that's a wonderful thing, because everybody can win from that. We'll be able to put more great ideas in front of audiences. Audiences will enjoy them more. In our case, they will respond by buying the brands that are bringing them those experiences, which will in turn grow those businesses, which will make our clients happy. That's what we should be thinking about AI for, the opportunity to bring more magical experiences to consumers by collapsing the gap of possibility of time and of money. if all we do is flood the world with an infinite amount of average content that is produced for free, we will have done the most heinous disservice to consumers, to businesses, and to mankind. And I'm an optimist. I think we're smarter than that. I think enough people will figure out how to use it as this magnificent value creator that the rest of us will have to follow. So I'm an optimist. I'm an optimist about it.
So we have a PhD student who literally was in my office this morning. She just got to Chicago and she's writing her dissertation on how an arts company grapples with AI. So she's literally meeting with all of us and she's seeing shows and, you know, and this is going to be a project over the course of a year. One of the things she said to me this morning that I thought was interesting, she says, you know, this technology doesn't think, it's predictive. It's making the prediction. So on the human end, the ability to provide valuable prompts, shifting context, and the ability to pivot are kind of essential. And I immediately went to like, great, that is what we do. We literally teach people to do that. And then that is a relationship with the technology, not a seeding to the technology.
And I mean, the words are so interesting, isn't it? Aren't they? Because people, like you said, her dissertation on how arts organizations are grappling with AI. Mm-hmm. And actually it's not grappling. It should be seizing with both hands and figuring out how much better this is going to make my work and my life, both. Mm-hmm. I think it can do both. I really do. I do think that, and it comes back to this thing of, are people born creative people are born creative, but do they lose it and can they recover it? And I think that's just going to be more obvious in the future, because unless you can think in a divergent way, you're not going to be able to get as much out of these AI tools as you possibly can, because you're not going to be able to make the pivot. You're not going to be able to make a connection that isn't based on something you've seen before. You're not going to be able to do all of those things unless you can think divergently. If you can, and hopefully more and more people will be able to, partly because we should be able to free up the time that is currently spent, as I said, trying to get something made as opposed to having new ideas, then it should be so good for people. But it's not going to be a question of just, you know, I think everybody who experiences it, everybody who works with it, and I remember this, and you will too. I remember this when Search came out. You thought, my God, look at that. it's very hard not to be awed by the speed and to genuinely be critical of the output. Mm-hmm. And I think we'll move through that and we'll start to be much more thoughtful about the output. And to your point, as a result of that, asking better questions, asking smarter questions, finding ways to pivot, finding ways to make connections that aren't there, but only because we've been able to see what is. I'm excited by it. I'm really excited by it.
In addition to the discussion,
I should just say, I think this is the distinction between creative. I mean, the PhD students looking at, I think you said, arts organizations. The distinction between being able to create things and produce things, that is going to be pulled apart, because the bit about producing them is going to be slightly different from what it has been in the past, because that's where AI can help a lot.
What I don't think is going to happen is that people will pay money to see AI do a comedy show. I don't think they're going to pay money to see AI do a concert.
No.
I could be wrong, but I don't think I am. I mean, I don't like that. There's something so sacred about these live spaces. You know, pick what you love to go see, whether it's an art gallery or a concert or, that human experience of being in the room with other people and experiencing this personal artistry is sacred. And you talk about the importance of ritual in the book. And I think those venues, those experiences are just rife with ritual that is different than the technology.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it didn't work out that great for all those tokenized artworks, did it?
No.
I mean, people did pay money for them. They just wish they had.
Exactly. I'm curious, you talk about there's a fair amount of leadership lessons inside this book. And one that you talk about is recognizing when you're in the seat you're in as a CEO, as a executive producer for me, I wish I had learned this one earlier, that people will not be candid with you. It's very hard for people, let me put it this way, it's very hard for people to be completely candid with you because of the seat you occupy. So if you want people to be candid with you, you have to do a lot of extra work. And yeah. Here's a couple things that I do was I used to say I have an open door policy. I stopped saying that, and I would pull people in.
Right.
And then I would move from behind my desk so I'm at the same level they are in my chair. And I would offer up something not deeply personal, but something personal. And I tried to create a space in which we could have these kinds of conversations. So you talk about this in the book, and I'm wondering, yeah. What were your techniques to sort of get people to tell you the truth?
Yeah. So, all of the things that you just said make a lot of sense. I think actually the other thing is I used to do this a lot, is just go and work in another agency. Uh-huh. And, just go and sit and do what I would be doing here, but somewhere else. And after a while, a couple of days, people get used to you being there. And it's not like a visit anymore. It's like you're there. And then you can just sense the barriers and the guards coming down. And people will just start to have a conversation with you if you prompt it, like you said.
Yeah.
And you hear things you wouldn't otherwise hear. And you know, well, I'm sure the same is true for you, is that so much is blindingly obvious to these people. Like, they know so much that you're not hearing. Mm-hmm. That if you can just unlock a bit of it, you end up getting a lot. You end up getting a lot. So I think things like you said, I think you've got to go to them,
yeah.
Not expect them to come to you, and physically going to them as well as conversationally going to them, I think is part of that. Again, if you get everybody in a room and say, right, who's got something they need to tell me, but the hands aren't going out, then everybody will be sitting on them. But I think it is, again, it's a conscious process that you work through in order to get people to unlock. Somehow that's what you're trying to do. You're always trying to get people to unlock, either to tell you stuff or to have ideas.
We used to do it. We don't do this anymore, which makes me a little sad. But what we used to do at Second City is every holiday party, the staff, so this would be box office, wait staff, managers, they would put on a show on our stage, and they would parody the scenes that were in the current Second City show to basically make fun of the executives. Whether it's like decisions we made, terrible decisions we made or whatever. And it was such a safe space in which people could speak truth to power. Mm-hmm. And inevitably, after those shows, we'd be sitting around as a leadership team and go, well, we should actually look at that, shouldn't we? You know, I want every company to have that or some version of that for themselves. Because I do think you need to go to sometimes extraordinary places to get that kind of input from your people. It's not going to happen with a suggestion box.
It's definitely not going to happen. But a suggestion box should really be called what it gets used for, which is a complaints box.
Yes,
it's never a suggestion box. It may be called that, but all you're ever going to get is complaints.
Yeah.
I did a presentation at Cannes 2 years ago. 2 years ago, called "But Seriously Though, Folks," mm-hmm. and the whole thrust of it, and it was something I really needed to get off my chest because I cared a lot about it. Was the importance and value of using humor in advertising to build business, and my concern that its use has been in decline. Mm. If you track the number of ads that use humor intentionally, it's been declining. And there's lots of reasons for that, but I wanted to make the case for bringing it back. And one of the fundamental points about it is it's really hard to be mad with anybody who makes you laugh. Really hard.
Yep.
And so if you're looking for genuine feedback and criticism, if you can find a way to make it fun, which the people, you know, all your people putting on a show at the holiday is exactly that. I'm sure it's very funny. I'm sure everybody laughs. Mm-hmm. But it's an incredibly effective way of not only giving them the ability to tell you, but also you the ability to hear it without anybody feeling grumpy about it. And it's, you know, it's a brilliant way to apologize. Ronald Reagan was a master at using humor to apologize. And this thing in the last week with, you know, the astronomer CEO and them yeah. using Gwyneth Paltrow as absolutely genius. Brilliant. Absolutely
yeah.
brilliant.
Yeah.
Because it makes you smile, and we all feel better when we smile. We all feel better when we smile. We all feel better when we laugh. And I actually think if you could, you know, that I haven't seen this done yet, but to get to the point where you gave people their performance reviews and you had to make them laugh would be an incredibly effective way of connecting people. Because, you, like you said, you can say things you wouldn't otherwise necessarily have the nerve to.
I don't know as a civilian that I marked that they were using humor less. It surprises me because of all the research we have around salience and surprise. These things yeah. that you're just trying and you have Geico, you know, which is they still yeah. use humor and it yeah. and they have more commercials than anyone. They must know something. And I'm curious why. And
why it's declined?
Yeah, my guess is it fear? Are people afraid of
it? I think there've been three big contributing factors. And if you look at the graph and where it drops, there are two big step downs. One was after the major financial crisis, 2008, 2009.
Yep.
And then again, during COVID. So I think there is a contextual concern where people think we shouldn't be funny at the moment because there's nothing funny going on in the world. Mm. Therefore, you know, we don't want to be seen to be tone deaf.
Yeah.
So we're not going to do anything funny. That's, it's understandable, but flawed. Because actually, if you look at the data, what people desperately need in toughest times is to laugh. There's a reason the word gallows humor exists. It's like that's as bad as it gets. Still, yeah. people want yeah. it's a great coping strategy. But I think that's one reason that caused big shifts. I think there is a second reason, which is it got harder. And I think this is one of the things people don't understand is just how hard it is to be funny.
Mm-hmm.
It got harder because there were many more landmines that people could stand on whilst getting a laugh. So it got harder to do. Didn't get impossible. Just got harder to do because you couldn't just use some of the easy tropes and tools that other people did. So I think that maybe took away. And then I think there was a third bit, which is the growth of purpose. As something that all brands should have.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I think a bit like the context question, you can have a very serious purpose. You just don't have to talk about it in a very serious way. Mm-hmm. And what happened is we got a lot of very earnest, serious communication about serious purposes. But I'm not arguing that you shouldn't have a purpose. You should. I'm just arguing that you may want to try and find a fun way to talk about it because it's more likely that people are going to like it and be engaged with it if you can. And so I think those three things, when you combine them, are probably what accounts for what has been a decline over 20 years.
So interesting. All right. In a moment, I'm going to ask you for your yes and story. But before I do that, let's talk about Taylor Swift. I'm a huge fan. I didn't know her work until the sort of modern era, and then I went into the back catalog. But one of the things that we both admire about her is something I admire in artists like David Bowie and Lou Reed and Neil Young, is they're constantly reinventing themselves.
Yeah,
they will not sit still. And it doesn't mean everything, you know, works, though in her case.
Yeah, pretty much. Right,
batting average is real, real high. So my colleagues and my kids introduced me to Taylor. How about you?
The same thing. I mean, I went to the Eras tour with my daughter. I mean, my daughter was 35 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And she and a best friend took me to the Eras concert. And I had heard some of her song and I thought she was good, but I was just blown away by the quality of that production.
Mm-hmm.
Just blown away by it because coming back to where we started with this, the importance of preparation, the importance of thinking everything through, there we were, MetLife Stadium, 85,000 people. I was literally the only one who didn't know and wasn't scream singing every word to every single line of every single song that she sang for 3.5 hours. It wasn't like an hour. It was 3.5 hours. The stage, it had been produced for a stadium. The stage was a video screen. Mm-hmm. And then there were these huge screens all around the stadium. And if at any point you looked at one of the screens, you were looking straight into her eyes, because she knew exactly where every single camera was, and she always was looking at a camera. So your view, even when you're right up on row 275 right at the gods, looking down, you're either seeing a fantastic visual performance on this stage, or you're looking straight into her eyes, and you have this curiously epic and intimate experience all the way through. And I was just blown away by the level of attention and preparation that had gone into that production. I've seen other, Coldplay does a great stadium performance, but I've never seen anything that good. And then a bit like you. So after that, I listened to a bit more music, but what I was more interested in was how she works and how hard she works and how she collaborates, nothing happens by accident. Everything is, everything is intentional. And I think this point that you said, she's always reinventing herself, is important, but it's better than that. She's always reinventing herself at the top.
Yeah.
So she has a monstrous success. She goes on this Eras tour, the most successful tour in the history of the business, and in the middle of it, drops 32 new songs. Mm-hmm. Not. In fact, I saw a meme this morning. It's 400 days since she dropped her last piece of music, which is the second longest hiatus there's been. So everybody's like, there's got to be one coming. But that level of commitment to always taking the next step, always making the next leap. And it's not a leap into the dark. It's very, very carefully thought through and perfectly executed. I just admire it. She said, there's a scene in Miss Americana, the movie, which if you haven't seen, you should.
I've seen it.
Okay. There's a wonderful scene in that where she says, other people will write better songs than me, but I want to be remembered as the smartest, hardest working artist. And I think she's living up to both.
Yeah, 1,000%. All right. We always end the podcast asking our guest for a yes and story. It feels like your life has been one giant yes and. Do you have a story for us?
Well, as I said to you earlier, I find it the beauty of the yes and approach is you do it all the time if it becomes part of it. But I think the biggest one for me was taking on as CEO of BBDO Worldwide, our big business opportunity then, and I'm going back 20 years, was to really develop our global clients, to win and develop global clients, because that was where the traffic was headed. And to do that, you needed to have a really high-functioning network. It had to really operate well as a network. And my brief coming in was we've got this fantastic federation of amazing agencies in different markets, all of whom are doing great work, but we turn it into a really good network for global clients. And I took that on, but it was a yes and be the most creative. Mm-hmm. Because there was an implicit assumption that you couldn't be a great network. You had to either be a great network or be creative. And for me, it was we'll be a great network and we're going to be the most creative network in the world. And I wanted it to be both. That's certainly the most significant if I look back on it, because that's what we spent a lot of time trying to do.
I love it. The book is called The Creativity Shift, How to Power Up Your Organization by Making Space for New Ideas. Andrew Robertson, thank you for coming on the pod.
Yes, and it's actually called The Creative Shift.
Yeah. Oh, the creative shift. I wrote it wrong. Oh my
it's
God.
Not a problem.
Never done that. The creative
you've added
shift.
A syllable. You built on it. That's great.
I you don't want me yes anding the title here. There are places where we don't yes and that one of them is changing the title of the book or getting it wrong. Andrew Robertson, thank you for coming on the podcast.
It's been great fun, Kelly. Thank you for having me.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.